This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/Solent.
BBC Radio Solent.
With the Big Dorset Brunch.
Hello and welcome to the Big Dorset Brunch podcast. My name's Zoe Kleinman and this is a free download from BBC Radio Solent. For more information on our programmes, go to bbc.co.uk/Solent. There were 2.2 billion people in the world with email addresses in 2012, according to the website Pingdom. And guess what? 61% of them were sharing emails you could politely call non-essential. I think I'm probably one of them. And my first guest is here to knock me back into virtual shape. Dr. Monica Seeley is an email expert from Bournemouth who's just finished running a week's worth of activities designed to get people clearing out their inboxes. Good morning, Monica.
Good morning, Zoe. Good morning, listeners.
So let's start with us here in Dorset. Are we a county of shameless email hoarders, do you think?
We are, but I have to tell you, I see some enormous inboxes on my travels.
Really? What counts as enormous in your world?
I spoke to somebody yesterday that had 4,600 emails in their box.
I can't imagine who that was. Seriously, you were shocked, weren't you, when I said that?
It is a lot. I mean, I assume that's just all sitting in your top inbox. They're not in folders or anything.
No, that doesn't include folders. I don't know how many are in the folders.
Zoe, that's large. You know, I'd ask you, how many of those do you really need?
Well, okay, here's the thing. I know it's horrific. I feel like if they were in a house, I wouldn't be able to get out the front door, would I? But But this is my work inbox we're talking about here. So I do two different jobs for the BBC. So I get two lots of work emails. And I realise this isn't really an excuse, is it? Because lots of people have different roles within their lives. But that's one of mine. Some of them have sentimental value. Some of them have contact details that I want to keep, like you, for example. All of your details I've got on my email. I don't have them filed anywhere else. So... But some of them are from people who I used to work with who've left or who I want to work with in the future. There's quite a lot of sentimental value to me. I suppose it's a bit of a keepsake box.
It is really. And, you know, it's interesting. We're encouraged by lots of the providers. You can have huge inboxes. But actually, the larger your inbox, the larger your carbon footprint, because one way or another, every time you switch your computer on, and you process those emails, you use up more resources, and it probably takes you a bit longer than if you had them well structured and organized. Although, so one is, I'm not a believer in keeping very large inboxes, but I would say your inbox to some extent is a picture of you.
This is like tidy desk, tidy mind, isn't it?
It is a little bit. But I would have said as a starting point is to try to clear some of that stuff into folders, the things that you really, really need. And always make sure, for example, that, as you said, with those contact details, I've got you going back for many years since we've worked together. But I have you in a folder marked PR, and I also have you in my contacts. So when I start typing... Zoe Kleinman comes up, and I think we see our inbox as a sort of dumping ground, which it isn't. It really should be like an in tray. It should be work in progress.
Space on servers is much bigger than it was. There's less pressure on people to keep their emails small. I mean, I remember getting warning messages saying you're over your quota, and then you were forced, weren't you, to go through and prune everything back. That doesn't really happen anymore. So does it matter?
Two things. It does. Certainly very big corporations still try, or even medium-sized ones, to keep to smaller inboxes, because the smaller the inbox, the more stable it is the first thing. It's a bit of a myth that big inboxes are okay. It's rather like putting on weight. It just gradually happens. The other thing as well, there is a legal aspect to all this, that buried in there, you may have emails that you really shouldn't be keeping. For example, if you were managing a team of people and somebody had been off sick, or even you had CVs in there from job applicants, anything that's got personal data in it, which relates to an incident, when the incident is finished, ideally you should get rid of that personal data because you haven't got my permission to keep it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there is that side to it as well. So I'm not a fan of big unruly inboxes. I'm much more into suggesting, for example, in your case, a good way would be to create yourself some folders, perhaps by going back by year, and move all that stuff out of your inbox, and then do a little bit of housekeeping.
I think that's a good idea. Actually, doing it by year would probably help me because, I mean, I did have a quick look at the bottom of it while we were playing a tune just now, and it does go back to 2002.
Right.
I probably don't actually need those emails anymore, do I?
No, it's from like letting go of old clothes, isn't it, that have great sentimental value. But you can keep the few like that, but it's all the email. I bet you've got all the email ping-pong that you and I played setting up this discussion.
Of course I have. And not only that, I remember us speaking before I went on maternity leave. So that's going back a couple of years. They're all there too. Because when I went to contact you, I was, this is another thing I spend a lot of time doing, looking for emails that I need. And I found a whole trail that we'd had. You know, it was quite nice, Monica. It was like eavesdropping on an old conversation we had. I felt nostalgic for you.
I think that's a lovely way of looking at it. And
utterly pointless though, isn't it?
Well, I have some. I have a very few. I have a folder called Zoe Kleinman, and I keep a few. So I've probably got one or two relating to this conversation. But I try to process them as I go along. So when I get an email from you and I've replied, I will delete the one from you because I know that later on in the day or the week even, you will come back to me. And at the end of the day, one of the key things is just to try to keep that one email that's got all the conversation in it.
Yeah, I see. So you keep the top one and then you've got everything else, haven't you,
that's
happened previously. Okay, Monica, three top tips. What can we do? I think folders is going to be one of them, isn't it?
Folders for you. I think the second thing is do something. Perhaps that's the first one, create a folder structure. The second one is do something. I call it the four Ds.
Yeah.
Deal, delete, delegate, or defer, but don't just read it, open it and leave it lying there because that's like driftwood coming up on the beach.
Right.
The third one is don't get distracted. Most people's day is run by email. So don't get distracted by new email. Pace yourself, switch off the new alerts, things like that. And you threw a fourth one in, so can I give you a fourth one?
Or
you
threw a third? All right, go on then.
The fourth one is pay attention to your email etiquette. Remember, email is a picture of you. So if you're out there applying for a job, responding to a customer, look at that email before you send it and say, what does it say about me and my business? Is the message clear? I've seen there are lots of cases where your email etiquette can cost you dearly in business. Your reputation, it can be destroyed in a nanosecond by something careless.
And finally, Monica, do you practice what you preach? How's your inbox?
I did count yesterday and I did clear it up.
Cheating.
I probably set aside about 10 minutes at the end of each day to just clear all the rubbish out. I've got about 20 in there, which will be dealt with by Monday.
I've got a long way to go. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Big Dorset Brunch. Have a lovely weekend, Monica.
And you. Thank you.
The Big Dorset Brunch
on BBC Radio Solent.
Earlier this week, a number of holiday chalets were damaged and shunted downhill by a landslip near Lyme Regis. It's the latest in a series of hazardous cliff incidents along the West Dorset Jurassic coastline over the last year. Our Dorset reporter Lawrence Herdman has more.
Well, this latest incident started on Tuesday morning. It's an area of the Jurassic coast to the west of Lyme Regis. Two wooden chalets started to slide downhill. Both were still connected to mains electricity at the time. Both now damaged considerably. One is actually sat at an angle of about 45 degrees. Eight other chalets also affected, most of them empty at this time of year, as you'd expect, although there were one couple that were taken away to safety. Monmouth Beach is around 12 miles west of Burton Bradstock. You may well remember a young woman lost her life in a cliff rockfall there last July. Well, Virgil Turner is the station commander at Lyme Regis Fire Station.
It's been happening over a number of months. We've actually been watching it for a long length of time. It's a what they call a low-level slide, I think, as far as the area where the chalets are classed as. So they're meant to go. It's meant to go at a low speed. As far as yesterday morning goes, come down here yesterday morning because my brother rung me up, because he's a councillor, and just concerned about things, and mainly concerned because the electric was still onto the actual properties. Even the two that were sliding was still had electric onto them, so he was concerned that they might go and catch fire, and then we've obviously got a job. So come down, had a look at them in the morning. Two properties severely damaged. We think another eight have affected, so a total of 10. They're moving. Spoke to one of the chalet owners out there yesterday that's got one of the chalets which is right on the bottom by the road, and he said that his had slid forward and that was right on the bottom by the road, so he was actually taking stuff out of his chalet because he was concerned that he would lose it. So regards to that, the electric people did come down yesterday and took the electric off to the properties involved, and that was my sort of thing. I just informed our fire control what was going on, just to update them, but there's no one in this time of the year, so it's good in a way.
Well, I spoke to quite a few locals near Lyme Regis Cobb on Wednesday morning. It does appear that this latest incident has been an event waiting to happen. Some feel that not all the chalet owners have been kept fully informed about the risk of landslips. Now, the access road to the chalets has been closed indefinitely by police. Daryl Turner is from Lyme Regis Town Council. He also sits on West Dorset District Council and told BBC Radio Solent the emergency response was handled well.
My brother-in-law was actually refurbished that one, and he phoned me up in the evening and said basically he thinks it's on the move. So I actually got the emergency process and it started with Dorset County Council. By the time I got my boots on and was halfway down the Cobb Road to here, the police blue lights came past me. So the response was really, really good from county. Within about half an hour, we had people down from West Dorset District Council. And again, there was nothing much we could do apart from cordon off the area.
Well, emergency planning inspectors from West Dorset District Council visited the site of the chalets at Monmouth Beach this week. They also updated on the latest phase of a multi-million pound land stabilisation project near East Cliff in Lyme Regis. An eight-week programme of work is due to start this month.
Lawrence Herdman reporting there.
BBC Radio Solent.
With the Big Dorset Brunch.
Dorchester is celebrating a special birthday this weekend. It's the 25th anniversary of the Dorchester Beerex Beer Festival. It started yesterday and it carries on this afternoon. Here to tell us more, with, I suspect, a bit of a sore head because you've just told me you had a late night, is one of the organisers, Rich Gabe. Hi, Rich.
Good morning, Zoe.
Welcome back.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Should I be speaking quietly?
No. One feels a little jaded, but not too bad.
You look very chipper for a man who was out to at least 1 o'clock in the morning at a beer festival. Well,
well,
done.
I was working.
Yeah,
so.
Working, all right.
No chestnut.
I wish my work involved more beer sometimes. It's not fair. How's it going then? Is it going well?
It's going very, very well. We've been extremely well supported. As you quite rightly said, it's our 25th year. Us, West Dorset Camera, with Dorchester Roundtable, and yesterday lunchtime, I'm really pleased to say we broke through the £100,000 mark that we've raised over the year for charities and local good causes. Yeah, so that was a celebration in itself.
That's fantastic. How many people are there?
There's 350 tickets per session over four sessions, so 1,400 people effectively are eligible.
That's a big festival, isn't it?
It's quite big. We've got 83 beers there from all across Dorset and all across various parts of the UK.
Yeah.
And various ciders and perries as well, which seem to be selling very well.
83?
Yeah.
That's
like I say, 12 ciders and perries as well.
That's quite a session, isn't it?
Yeah. A bit too much to drink all at once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Are there any favourites emerging this year, would you say? Any particularly busy stalls?
Well, the first beer to sell out was St. Austell. Proper Job IPA, which, funnily enough, was the first beer to sell out last year.
Oh, really? What's it like? Why didn't you bring some?
Well, we did the tasting thing, didn't and I just feel that, you know, it might be a bit rude for me to force beer on you at this time of the morning.
Yeah, how dare you? That would have been outrageous.
Exactly.
No, seriously, what does it taste like?
It's very hoppy because it's a pale ale. It's about 4.5%. Mm-hmm. Got a bit of a flowery aroma to it. It's very, very drinkable. It's quite pale to amber in colour, I would say. Seems to be going exceedingly well.
What's the magic ingredient, do you think? What's making it so popular?
That particular beer?
Yeah.
Hops. Yeah, it's a very hoppy beer. Obviously, hops go into all beers.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think this is Hobbs. And I think it's also quite a well-known, established name.
Right.
So sometimes people look for things they recognise. Other people search out new beers, breweries they've never heard of before.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got a real good cross-representation. Extremely well supported by our local brewery, the Dorset Piddle Brewery.
Yeah.
Been a main sponsor. So they've got a good selection of beers there, which hopefully local people will recognise. But then, like I say, you've got beers from Palmer's, which are relatively local. And also, like, St Austell.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite a big Cornish brewery.
Cornish brewery, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, Rich, you're a member of Camera, aren't you? And you're also a rather expert beer drinker. But is there anything new for you?
New for me?
Yeah.
Well, I order all the beers. So I guess I try and look for good local support, stuff beers I know are good,
yeah,
which I've drunk before. But then there's probably about 40, 45 beers there that I've ordered from all across parts of the UK, and I would say a good 30, 35 of them I've never tried before, although I always like to put something in the mix that I know is good.
Yeah,
that,
sure.
You know, I'd think, yeah.
You need old favourites as well, don't you?
And I know that even though this brewery comes from up north, I've drunk it before, I know people are going to like it down here because it is good beer.
And can people still come along today to the Beer X Festival?
We've sold out tickets, sadly. Yeah, it seems to be happening now every year. The festival's getting so popular. People are even pre-ordering their tickets online via the West Dorset Camera website. It's a problem that we need to address. However, we love having our festival in the Corn Exchange. We have for the last 25 years. And we need to maybe look at contingency plans for the future about how we're going to run the event.
Well, good luck this afternoon. Have a fantastic time. And I'm guessing tomorrow will be a recovery day.
Well, we'll be down there at 9 o'clock in the morning taking it all apart.
Oh, no rest for the wicked, is there? Rich
Gay,
thank you very much for joining us here on the Big Dorset Brunch.
BBC Radio Solent
with Zoe Kleinman.
There are fears that benefit changes as part of welfare reform will lead to an increase in homelessness. One Dorset council is setting up a multi-agency working group to help mitigate the impact of welfare reform. Meanwhile, the chief executive of another Dorset authority says they have already seen the number of homeless rise. Our Dorset political reporter Tristan Pascoe has more.
The backdrop to this is money. Since the government scrapped the National Council Tax Relief Scheme, councils across the south are preparing to implement their own local council tax support. The catch is that local authorities are only being given 90% of the funding from the government that they had in the previous year, so in effect are being asked to do more for less. Consequently, councils are trying lots of different ways to make up that shortfall. For example, free early morning travel on buses for pensioners in North and West Dorset is being restricted. Many councils are targeting second homes that have previously benefited from council tax reduction. But it's the changes to benefit claimants that's causing the most concern, particularly about homelessness. Bournemouth Borough Council is asking claimants who've previously had their council tax paid in full to now make a contribution of 20%. Just this week, Poole Borough expressed fears for homelessness increasing, and the chief executive of the Christchurch and East Dorset Partnership, David McIntosh, shares those concerns.
Well, the government's policy changes are designed to protect the most vulnerable. Time will tell whether that actually happens. We're already seeing homelessness increasing as it is, so we have genuine concerns that will be a continuation of that. But it's very difficult, and some councils have spent an awful lot of time and effort to try to foretell the impact of this, and it's difficult. So we will be ready to respond when the changes come.
Weymouth Borough Councillor Rachel Rogers says many local schemes are flawed. The people who've been getting council tax benefit, she says, do so because they're so poor and low paid or surviving on benefits. She says councils are targeting the poorest people for money that they simply don't have.
They won't be able to pay, they'll fall into debt, they may end up with convictions through non-payment of fines and ultimately homelessness. And at the same time, our councils are going to be spending increasing amounts of money chasing essentially something that they're never going to get. So they're going to be spending money to try and get unpaid council tax, and they're never going to get it because lots of these people are going to default. And most of the budgets are predicated on getting something like 98% of the council tax in. Frankly, I think that's a fantasy. And what's very rarely costed is how much it's going to cost to get that money back. So that's why I say it's not only morally shameful, but also financially wasteful.
Some councils are trying to mitigate the impact of welfare reforms. North Dorset District Council are collaborating with job clubs, housing associations and investing in mobile tablet devices to help deal with those most affected. Bournemouth Borough Council are setting up a special welfare hardship fund to the tune of £750,000. But the homelessness charity Shelter is warning that in just weeks from now, many families will suddenly see a huge chunk taken out of their weekly budget, may find it difficult to pay their rent, and ultimately could lose their homes.
Tristan Pascoe reporting there.
The Big Dorset Brunch
on BBC Radio Solent.
It's time now to take a look at something that's been in the headlines this week. In Chesil Cove, we've seen problems with the birds this week, particularly with guillemots and razorbills. Our reporter Tim Robinson joined RSPCA Inspector John Cooper there at first light on Friday morning as they ventured onto the beach.
Is that one there? We're just making our way down Chesil Cove. There's a guillemot here on the high tide line. Already, just in the few metres square that I can see, several dead birds. One just been brought in by the tide on the edge of the shoreline, and here at the high water line where there's all sorts of flotsam and litter and bits of driftwood and rubbish, a dead bird covered in this white waxy substance. But there is one bird, if we believe, is still alive down the shoreline. He's flapping desperately, trying to make his way back into the sea. So we've moved along the beach. We found another six dead guillemots, but one live one. John is just trying to coax it away from the sea towards the shore so he can get it into his net. And thankfully, the guillemots aren't too mobile because, of course, they're covered in this substance. He's just chased after it. And a quick flick of his net, managed to pin it against the beach. He's just taking it out of the net now. It doesn't seem too badly hurt. John's just trying to put the guillemot back in the box.
There we go. It's still thin, very thin. It's not heavily contaminated, it's sort of light contamination, really, which is lucky.
Well, they've rescued one bird and turned straight around and seen another. It's that kind of morning now as the tide begins to peak and turn. The frequency at which these birds are arriving on the shore is increasing. So I'm with Mark Smith from the Dorset Wildlife Trust. We've got... Is it a guillemot? I'm not sure.
This one's actually a razorbill. So they're all orcs, guillemots and razorbills. And these guys both spend, you know, most of their lives out at sea. So these are the guys that are quite susceptible to this kind of a substance floating around in the water. This material seems to float just below the surface, kind of in the water column, not at the surface. So as these birds swim around diving for fish, they're getting coated in this substance, which is obviously sticking them together. Because it sticks their feathers together, they can't preen them, and it takes the oil and stuff out of it as well. So effectively, they just freeze to death, or they can't swim, so they starve.
And we're just about to pop this one back into the van. What happens next? These are going off to Somerset to be cleaned by some sort of specialists.
Yeah, so these are the lucky ones that we've rescued. These guys are going to make their way down to Taunton. The RSPCA have already treating, I think it's around about 127 that we've collected. We've got about another 10 live ones in the van at the moment already. So these will make their way to Taunton to get kind of cleaned up.
And this one's desperately trying to bite your fingers.
Well, I guess we kind of deserve it, don't we? Because we're the humans that put this substance out in the water in the first place.
And that must be the most frustrating thing for people like you who spend your life, you know, working for the protection of nature and studying it and all the rest of it. It must be so frustrating that one callous act, you know, a few hundred miles out to sea can have this effect on hundreds, if not thousands, of seabirds.
Oh, absolutely. At the moment, we don't know the extent of how many birds are affected, but also we don't know what other marine life out there is going to be affected. And we kind of have some of the most spectacular marine wildlife, you know, in the UK. Dorset is just rich in so many different marine species. We don't know how this substance is affecting the whole ecosystem out there. And that's quite worrying.
Tim Robinson reporting there.
BBC Radio Solent
with Zoe Kleinman.
There are fears that benefit changes as part of welfare reform will lead to an increase in homelessness. One Dorset council is setting up a multi-agency working group to help mitigate the impact of welfare reform. Meanwhile, the chief executive of another Dorset authority says they have already seen the number of homeless rise.
Our Dorset political reporter Tristan Pascoe has more.
The backdrop to this is money. Since the government scrapped the National Council Tax Relief Scheme, councils across the south are preparing to implement their own local council tax support. The catch is that local authorities are only being given 90% of the funding from the government that they had in the previous year, so in effect are being asked to do more for less. Consequently, councils are trying lots of different ways to make up that shortfall. For example, free early morning travel on buses for pensioners in North and West Dorset is being restricted. Many councils are targeting second homes that have previously benefited from council tax reduction. But it's the changes to benefit claimants that's causing the most concern, particularly about homelessness. Bournemouth Borough Council is asking claimants who've previously had their council tax paid in full to now make a contribution of 20%. Just this week, Poole Borough expressed fears for homelessness increasing, and the chief executive of the Christchurch and East Dorset Partnership, David McIntosh, shares those concerns.
Well, the government's policy changes are designed to protect the most vulnerable. Time will tell whether that actually happens. We're already seeing homelessness increasing as it is, so we have genuine concerns that will be a continuation of that. But it's very difficult, and some councils have spent an awful lot of time and effort to try to foretell the impact of this, and it's difficult. So we will be ready to respond when the changes come.
Weymouth Borough Councillor Rachel Rogers says many local schemes are flawed. The people who've been getting council tax benefit, she says, do so because they're so poor and low paid or surviving on benefits. She says councils are targeting the poorest people for money that they simply don't have.
They won't be able to pay, they'll fall into debt, they may end up with convictions through non-payment of fines and ultimately homelessness. And at the same time, our councils are going to be spending increasing amounts of money chasing essentially something that they're never going to get. So they're going to be spending money to try and get unpaid council tax, and they're never going to get it because lots of these people are going to default. And most of the budgets are predicated on getting something like 98% of the council tax in. Frankly, I think that's a fantasy. And what's very rarely costed is how much it's going to cost to get that money back. So that's why I say it's not only morally shameful, but also financially wasteful.
Some councils are trying to mitigate the impact of welfare reforms. North Dorset District Council are collaborating with job clubs, housing associations and investing in mobile tablet devices to help deal with those most affected. Bournemouth Borough Council are setting up a special welfare hardship fund to the tune of £750,000. But the homelessness charity Shelter is warning that in just weeks from now, many families will suddenly see a huge chunk taken out of their weekly budget, may find it difficult to pay their rent, and ultimately could lose their homes.
Tristan Pascoe reporting now.
The Big Dorset Brunch
on BBC Radio Solent.
A row is brewing in the posh eateries of New York as diners increasingly decide to take pictures of their food and post them online. Some chefs say it disturbs other diners, and third-rate snaps taken on a camera phone are doing a huge disservice to their culinary creations. Well, let's start with one of the culprits. Yesterday, I caught up with John Grindle, a.k.a. West Dorset Foodie, who takes pictures of locally served dishes for his blog. I began by asking him to tell us all about the blog.
Well, the blog is all about restaurants and foodie shops and foodie suppliers in the West Dorset area.
And do you whip your camera out without shame?
I don't whip it out. I'm as covert as possible. Try not to disturb the other diners. Definitely wouldn't use flash. And I just take a picture of the food as quickly as possible.
Have you ever had a hard time over it?
No, I can't say I have. I've only had thanks, really. In some restaurants, the actual chef comes out and takes a group picture of you sometimes, if you're lucky.
So you're a bit of a local celebrity?
No. I try to keep as low profile as possible.
What do you think about this row that's been brewing then? Do you think the chefs have a point?
I think they have a point. If I went in there with tripods, lights, standing on the chair to take the photograph, yes, but I'm just taking a quick picture of their food, which hopefully they're very proud of because they're charging you for it, and away I go.
And what would your top tips be for getting a good shot?
Top tip? Don't use a flash, obviously, because that's going to disturb everybody and it doesn't produce a good picture. Try and get a window table, natural light and that sort of thing. And get ready for the food to arrive, you know, sort of prepare a stage for it, you know, with a nice glass of wine in the background or something like that.
What kind of food takes the best picture?
What type of very good food? interesting food, well-prepared, well-presented.
Is there anything that always looks awful, no matter what you do?
If you haven't got good light, if you haven't got good light, you have to hold the camera very still for a little while, and that's the worst, and then you can't use it. And if you don't take a very good photo, always have a fiddle with it with some good photo editing software, because you can adjust the hue and saturation and everything, and sometimes they come out all right doing that.
Is there an etiquette involved? Do you ask permission?
Not really, no. I never really thought of etiquette. Hopefully, nobody really notices that I'm doing it.
John Grindle there, a.k.a. West Dorset foodie. Well, time now to talk to Russell Brown, who owns the Michelin-starred Dorchester restaurant Sienna. He's here in the studio with me right now. Hello, Russell.
Hi there.
OK, so you just heard that. We've got a West Dorset foodie taking pictures surreptitiously. What do you think about that?
I suppose that's part of the secret, isn't it? It's about not disturbing other people and being discreet about it. So, and John does a good job. So,
does it bother you? There you are. You've got a Michelin-starred restaurant. You've got all of your publicity carefully planned out. I'm sure you've got fantastic, glossy marketing pictures. And then in slopes somebody with a cheap smartphone and start snapping away. Is there a bit of you that thinks, oh, no?
No, I don't think there is, really. We've all seen, I think every chef has seen photographs of their food and they think, oh, that doesn't really do it justice. Yeah, and we do pay professional photographers to do what we want for our marketing and magazines and so on. But at the end of the day, the photographs I put on Twitter and on Facebook, I take on my phone.
You're at it as well.
You know, so I'm perhaps a culprit as much as anybody.
Are you finding it more and more people are doing it in your restaurant?
You do notice it, yes. Yeah, and they're people who do, you know, an excellent job. You look at blogs from people like The Critical Couple and on Twitter, and, you know, the standard of food photography there is excellent.
And I mean, obviously, you're saying that you don't really mind. Do you know any local chefs that get a bit uptight about it?
No.
I'm not asking you to name and shame. I'm just interested.
No, I don't think I've ever heard anybody, you know, outright complain about it. You know, as I said, you might occasionally come across a photograph and you look at it and you think, well, that's not really what the dish looks like, or that doesn't do it justice.
Yeah. But, that must be quite irritating.
It's a bit frustrating, yes, but, you know, we live in a world where there's a massive online community now, and I don't think there's a lot you can do about it, to be honest.
Do you think it's disruptive? And it must be disruptive when a massive group of people start clumping together to get in a picture.
I think it can be sometimes, but to be fair, most people are pretty good about it, and, you know, they try and be as discreet as possible.
I love the fact that you were telling me earlier that you don't mind people taking pictures of the food, but actually photographers get a bit annoyed because they don't think they're properly light balanced or whatever.
No, exactly. I was talking to Richard Budd, who does our photography for us, about this, and he was saying that it's obviously not a professional studio shot. And I suppose you can argue from a chef's point of view, it's not representing your food at its best. But as I said, you know, it's part of life today. So,
But it is kind of your shop window. I mean, Dorchester has been hit pretty hard, I think, by the economic downturn. There's quite a few empty shops now, and there's lots and lots of sales going on, and it does feel like businesses are struggling a bit. Are you concerned that somebody might see a less good photo and think, oh, I'm not going to bother eating there?
I hope not. I think if you look at the online community as a whole, you take into account, you know, bloggers, the food photographs, TripAdvisor, all that sort of thing, and I hope that most people are intelligent enough to take a balanced view about things. You know, if you look at TripAdvisor, for example, and you see a restaurant's got 50, 60 reviews, 40 of them are very good, 5 of them are average, a couple of them are awful. You know, people don't pick up on the odd bad review, they take it as a balance, and I'm sure the same's true with the photography.
So. How is the high-end food business treating you?
We're doing okay at the moment, touch wood. We'd say we're having to work harder at it, I think. A lot of things like the PR, the publicity, getting out and doing the demos and all that sort of thing, we are working hard at. But we are fortunate that it does seem to be holding up fairly well at the moment.
Do you think the Michelin star is obviously a big kudos for you? Do you think that's helped?
Massively. We saw a big upturn in business when we got the star, and it helps as much as anything with the harder to sell times, I suppose, just because it makes people more aware. People are travelling from further afield, so we found that lunch times are busier, midweek dinners are busier. We've always been solid at the weekends, that sort of thing, but it certainly helped.
I remember interviewing Sheila Dillon, the food critic, once, and she said, be very wary of restaurants that offer meal deals, tenner for two courses or something, because often you are getting what you pay for, and it's not going to be perhaps the best quality food, or it's going to be cheap food, pasta or, soup or something. Do you agree with that?
I think that's down to the skill of the chef to a great extent. I would say that the cheaper ingredients you're using to make good food, the more work you have to put into it. Whether it's long, slow cooking to render tougher pieces of meat delicious, or things like that. So I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that really does depend on what the chef's actually doing.
So the secret is really in the cooking rather than in the ingredients sometimes.
I think so. You can produce great food from some of the cheapest ingredients. Homemade bread as an example. You don't get much cheaper than flour, water, yeast and salt.
It takes forever though, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. It's just about being organised.
I quite enjoy making bread, but I do get a bit annoyed, and you do something quite quickly and then it says, leave it in the oven for an hour and a half. An hour and a half? And then take it out and then pound it for 10 minutes and then put it back in the oven. I'm like, oh my goodness, I want a sandwich now, not in 4 days' time. I have to
be
organised.
That's just about planning.
And impatience, I know. Russell, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
For joining us here on the Big Dorset Brunch.
Through the morning
with Zoe Kleinman
on BBC Radio Solent.
Tributes have continued to be paid all week to 17-year-old student Ella Pallister, who died after injuries sustained in a show jumping accident. Ella had been taking part in a competition at Kingston Marwood College, just outside of Dorchester, last Sunday. The teenager was taken to Dorset County Hospital and then flown by air ambulance to Southampton General Hospital. However, she died on Wednesday. A statement on the British Show Jumping Association confirmed the news. Ella was in year 13. She'd been studying for her A-levels at the Thomas Hardy School in Dorchester, and she was also doing a BTEC at Kingston Marwood. Our Dorset reporter Lawrence Herdman spoke to the head teacher at Thomas Hardy, and he started by asking about Ella's sporting talent.
I'm no expert, but certainly, talking to the, to students here who've ridden with her and so on, they've spoken about her talent and her passion and, for the sport. And she was a talented sportswoman, not just the horse riding, but she was also a good hockey player. And, of course, as part of her A-level PE course, she was doing, specialist study in terms of horse riding and hockey. So she obviously was, very able and very passionate about her sport. And, clearly, that was an avenue that, she presumably could have pursued.
What did her teammates in the equestrian team say about her and her talents?
How able and experienced she was, and her ability, and her affinity with horses and so on. I mean, I think they spoke about her in very glowing terms, and what she was like, and how long she'd been riding, and so on. So, obviously she had many different talents, but this was one of her passions.
How tough have the last few days been?
Well, it's a devastating time for any school when a tragedy like this happens, and it has been very tough. The students have responded marvellously to this in terms of coming together, supporting each other, and, of course, a very difficult time for the staff as well when a young person loses their life in these awful circumstances. So it has been very hard, but the community have come together and supported each other.
And just listening to some of the children talking about Ella, it seems as though she was everyone's friend. She had such a bright future. How would you describe Ella?
She was. I didn't teach Ella myself, but certainly all the staff and all the students have spoken about her, you know, her cheerfulness, about her wonderful attitude, you know, to life and the support that she was willing to give. She was a very talented sportswoman and very much, you know, a centre of the community and, you know, a very pivotal person in her tutor group. And, you know, the response from students towards her has been excellent, and in terms of, you know, how they've spoken about her and their memories of her, and that's very precious.
Not only her equestrian skills and her her excellence at show jumping, but academically very bright as
well. Yeah, she was, and, you know, she was studying applied business and PE, and where she was able to make the most of, obviously, her, you know, sporting abilities. And I think that is the tragedy, that you've got somebody who is really on the cusp of life and, you know, all the opportunities that it had to offer. And, you know, to have it, you know, taken away in these awful circumstances is, you know, is the tragedy. And I think the thing we were all finding it hard to get to grip with.
How do you attempt to move forward? I mean, will there be a legacy left? Are you thinking of a tribute or any memorial?
We are. We held an assembly yesterday for the sixth form to try and, you know, share the information that we had and a chance for them to come together. And what we've done is we've tried to maintain a routine, which I think in these circumstances is important. But at the same time, if people have found it difficult to cope, we've put quiet areas aside for them to go to. And what we said at the assembly yesterday is, at the moment, it's all very raw. It's very difficult to think beyond, you know, the immediate. But there will come a time, clearly. And I have said to the rest of the sixth form, there will come a time when we'll be able to sit down and really think carefully about how we want to celebrate Ella's life and what sort of legacy that we want to leave from her time here. And that's what we'll do. But at the moment, I have to say, it is all very raw, and it's very difficult to look beyond the next few days at the moment.
Lawrence Herman reporting there.
The Big Dorset Brunch
on BBC Radio Solent.